can't live my life this way. Continually get high instead of run around like one bird down. It's a new day. Gotta do it big just to get by.
Well, welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. We're returning with Leanne Hurstman, who's editor of Aura Now series, and I was fortunate enough to join her on this issue 7 as co-editor, and she teaches at the National School for Strategic Organizing at the Strategy Center. So, Leanne, you wrote this article. It's Socialist Feminism, Reflections After 30 Years. Now, you're taking us in terms of a whirlwind of looking at how it's part autobiographical. It looks at your own story as the development of women's liberation and national liberation and your own trajectory to where you're at now. Can you start with just talking a little bit about how, what kind of breakthrough was socialist feminism in the 70s?
Sure, I'd be happy to. First, I want to say that I'm really excited about the issue that we produced that would have Vijay and what he's got to contribute right alongside my history and what I've got to contribute. Pretty hot stuff. Anyway, if you're asking about the birth of socialist feminism, I think actually Vijay helped in a certain sense of give us an idea of the vibrancy of the historical period that we were in. Socialist feminism grew in the early 70s. The organization that I was particularly involved with forming, called the Berkeley Oakland Women's Union, formed in 1973. But this was in the middle of all the activism around the war, the end of the civil rights movement, the rise of black power, national liberation movements all over the world, and in fact, women revolutionaries in struggles all over the world, like China and Cuba, had already, if you might say, crafted socialist feminism, although they didn't call it that. And so when we reflect back on what was the state of both the women's movement in the United States and the left movement in the United States, it was clear there was really a big lack in both of them in terms of their theoretical frameworks about the third world and about the integration of gender, race, and revolutionary class struggle. So anyway, I would say it was born out of that. And the really exciting thing was, because of the nature of the times, it seems difficult to imagine right now, but socialists actually became feminists, and feminists actually became socialist, which today seems highly unlikely. It seems like a very different tradition. But the unifying, oddly enough, I think the unifying goal of the project was to somehow bring together these two political trends within the United States in a way that could join a more third world-oriented revolutionary movement around a unity around anti-racism.
You know, Vijay was talking about earlier about just that the Iraqi Communist Party was a mass question. There's 500,000 people. Can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, it's hard for people to imagine now women's liberation in terms of the mass character of it as it was in the 70s, and what kind of structure that people actually have to allow women's participation in terms of revolutionary organization, and what were kind of things that people thought about in terms of allowing space for women to be able to, one, carry on political work and then move outside or inside the factories or even outside of the house.
Well, I would say that socialist feminist unions, which is what they were called as a form of organization, were built all around the country. And looking in retrospect, I think we would say that they were a major sort of transitional form between women who had worked either in women-only organizations or had worked around women-only issues, or women who had been working in left organizations and were furious and, you know, disparaged and belittled and basically had to get out of there. So these unions, which used similar to how the bus riders union does, borrowed the union concept as a way of saying this is a syndicate, a sindicato. It has a working class character to it. And that's the message that we want to see organizing all around the country. So I would say that these organizations in and of themselves did not produce a really large number of individual women at the national conference, the one national conference that took place. It was 1,600 women that got together in Yellow Springs, Ohio. But if you think of the power and influence and the base that these women had, both in the women's movement and back in their own multi-gender organizations, the struggle that took place at that meeting, basically over real contradictions between what does feminism mean for third world women and what does socialism mean for lesbians, very real contradictions that were addressed at that time, and all those people were in the same room. So I guess I see it as a transitional form from organizations that a lot of women could not go back to, and the absence of new forms of organization that would have to come out of this, born out of contradictions of socialist feminism.
Well, one of the things, we're with Leanne Hurst Mann, the editor of ORNL, who's going to be one of the speakers this Thursday night at the forum on 2845 West 7th at 7 o'clock. Leanne, you know, one of the things about this period in history is things moved rapidly. You know, people went from SNCC to the Black Panthers in 3 years. You moved from the Berkeley-Oakland Women's Union to the August 29th movement, which is a Marxist-Leninist organization, to the League of Revolutionary Struggle. What led you and other women inside the socialist feminist movement to then choose Marxism-Leninism? And for many of our listeners, wouldn't Marxism-Leninism be perceived as an anti-feminist concept to some people? Why did you think it had a feminist content or even a feminist drive?
Well, help me hold on to that question.
Okay.
I'm not looking at the clock, but
you're
fine. In terms of how fast the time period was, I just realized I wanted to punctuate that it was in 1968 that I actually married a man who stood in the door of the kitchen and told me how to cook. From there in 1968, I immediately went into consciousness-raising groups, which blew out my marriage completely. Then People's Park, the Vietnam War, Black Panthers, you know, it was, I think, a very important point that you're making that we don't see right now, but how fast things were moving. So one of the terms I know that I used in my article a lot is the fervor of the time. And I think we were, in fact, pretty good intellectuals, but we also were young, and there was like a fever in the country and around the world that you had to act. You had to act, and in order to act, you had to have a form of organization. Of course, today there are plenty of people acting who don't see the need for forms of organization, but at the time we did. And the reason that I ultimately, after investing a great deal in building the Berkeley-Oakland Women's Union, ultimately moved into the form of a Marxist-Leninist organization, which happened to be the August 29th movement, ATM, apropos today. The reason was basically because the best argument that socialist feminism could put forward about the analysis of the status of women in the world was that women could not be liberated under capitalism. And it was a very radical statement. We need socialism. And ultimately, what we were building at the time was a predominantly white organization. I was interested in doing multiracial organizing, moving into a direction that had a greater strategic thrust, and basically wanted to be part of a very feminist tradition in the global anti-imperialist movement.
But to just, that was great. And then in terms of giving it some, you know, sort of help folks with a little more specifics, you went to work in an auto factory. You tell them about the League's child care policy, because, again, that explains the strategic reason, but a lot of women might say, yeah, but when you got there, you're fine. When you got there, it was not a good experience for women, you know, but you actually thought it was a very good experience for women. So help us understand what a black and Latino and Asian and white group of young people trying to make a revolution, how they dealt with women's liberation issues and how they dealt with child care issues.
Good. I'm glad you brought me that back to that, because I think that historical memory is totally lost. The perspective we have today is so anti-communist and so reconstructive inaccurately that you're right. People do think that a communist organization couldn't possibly have a great child care program. But the truth of the matter was that if women in China were carrying babies on their backs with rifles and were part of the revolutionary armed struggle, no organization could grow and recruit a multiracial membership without being avidly feminist. And it wasn't just like a tactical plan. It was just the truth. And the women who were in leadership were very much as in the fore as anyone else of trying to build a new communist movement. Some of the greatest theoreticians we had were women. My particular draw, or at least one of them, was to design and operate the child care system in Los Angeles. And, you know, it's hard to imagine it today, but we had both we had lots and lots of children in our organization, which is also not very common today. And in order to do that, that's what you have to do if you want to have lots and lots of women. Then you have to provide child care. So we had elaborate paid daytime child care programs, not provided by us. But we did set up, among our membership and allies and friends, a child care system that meant that any woman could have a place to take her kid any day of the night, 7 days a week, any time of the day on Saturday and Sunday. And basically, we did our dead-level best to make it so that no woman would have any jeopardy in being able to do the kind of work that she wanted to do. So that if you wanted to work 60 hours a day or a week on an assembly line.
Which you did.
Which I did, and which I did while I was pregnant, the organization backed that up.
Well, within the last couple of minutes, and we've got a couple more minutes left, could you talk a little bit, I mean, you just alluded to the role of yourself as a conscious left organizer on the shop floor. You were a union steward. You helped start the Berkeley-Oakland Women's Union. You were in radical psychiatry. You're in a cadre form. So by ending within the last minute or two, talk about all these building blocks of your past and the synthesis of it to where you're currently at as a political being.
Well, I think synthesis is the key term here. There's very little that I've ever done, and I would say I like the word discovered, you know, along my path, that I would take back. I've had tremendous opportunities in each path I went. I stumbled on new and wonderful things. So I guess the answer to the question is that the building blocks that have brought me to work in the National School for Strategic Organizers and at the Strategy Center have been essentially women's liberation, anti-racism, anti-imperialism, pro-socialism.
Well, that was a quick one. I guess we're actually going to be wrapping up. Thank you so much. That was Leanne Hurstman, editor of Aura Now and teacher at the National School for Strategic Organizing. I'm your co-host, Tammy Bang-Lu, here with Eric Mann. You've been listening to Voices from the Front Lines. Thanks for joining us today. We'd like to thank our guests, Vijay Prashad and Leanne Hurstman. We had music from Omaya, Dilated Peoples, and El Chicano. You can get previous shows at www.thestrategycenter.org and our comments line, voices@thestrategycenter.org. And as Eric said, come on and join us this Thursday at Cadesan, 7 p.m. Again, today is the 35th anniversary of the Chicano Moratorium. Rasta Si Gera No was a chant heard throughout the Chicano movement, and we need to hear more of today. Till next week. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman.
You've been listening to the 4 o'clock report, Voices from the Frontline edition, on community-based KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and globally at kpfk.org. Stay tuned to hear Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. It's coming up next.